From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I discuss President Obama's announcement that the United States will normalize its relations with Cuba, and the cyber attack on Sony for its coming release of a film featuring the assassination of North Korean President Kim Jong-un.
A North Korea who's sitting isolated in Asia may not have the military capacity to get at a country like the United States, but they do apparently have the cyber capacity to wreak havoc.
Then I'm joined by OU's Director of Religious Studies, Charles Kimball.
You know, when you're standing on the edge of a cliff, progress is not defined as one step forward. Can we identify some of the warning signs of religion going awry?
I'll talk with one of the country's leading scholars about the intersection of the three Abrahamic religious traditions. But the news is coming up next. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. Rebecca Cruz, we've been in Mexico this week for work, but the big news in Latin America was Cuba. President Obama announced this week that the United States will normalize its relationship with Cuba. The embargo will stay in place because only Congress can lift that, but there'll be an embassy that comes to Cuba. There were some prisoners that were swapped. There will be eased restrictions on travel and banking, remittances, financial transactions. So this is a big deal, huge deal. What are the implications of this?
Well, yes, it's a big deal. As you said, this embargo was put in place over 50 years ago. It's outlasted multiple presidents. And here we are today talking about perhaps normalizing relations. Congress is going to play an important role here. They are the ones that have the power of the purse. And so they get to determine appropriations for even the embassy and for other things. So we will continue to watch that for sure. But I think that this is really symbolic in many ways. It's lasted for quite a long time. And obviously, we have a very large population of Cuban Americans here. And so they are reacting to this, as our citizens in Havana and in Cuba. And we're getting very mixed responses on both sides of this situation. Many people in Cuba seem very happy. They're elated that perhaps this normalization will lead to more trade, that there will be more goods there, that they will be able to develop further. Though there are others that say that this is not necessarily going to change human rights violations in Cuba. And on this side, of course, there's many in the United States that have been looking forward to this for quite some time. In fact, if we look at Gallup polls since 1999, a majority of Americans have favored removing the embargo or at least normalizing relations. So this has been a long time coming, but we're also seeing congressional members that are saying that they will potentially block some of this progress.
Well, definitely feelings on both sides, like you mentioned. But it's interesting to note that Pope Francis played a significant role in this. There have been 18 months of secret talks going on before this was announced and the prisoner swap happened. That's pretty significant, too, that you have the Vatican engaged in creating peace, hopefully, between these two nations.
Well, certainly not a new thing for the Vatican. We saw Pope John Paul certainly involved in Cold War negotiations previously that perhaps led to the end of the Cold War. But yes, it takes a unique individual and someone who has ties to Latin America, perhaps certainly the Catholic ties, and someone that has some legitimacy here with the United States as well. So very significant. Also interesting, this prisoner swap, while one of the prisoners we've heard a great deal about, another apparently was a security official that had been doing a lot of work in Cuba. And so that's actually probably the big person that's being brought back to the United States.
Well, speaking of security issues, let's jump to North Korea and the cyber attack that happened, state-sponsored North Korean attack, cyber attack on Sony Pictures, on Sony Corp, for its coming release of the film The Interview, where part of the plot has to do with an assassination of Kim Jong-un. So this is huge for two reasons, right? The impact on the entertainment industry, that we actually had a response from the entertainment industry, but also the U.S. government has come out and said this is a national security matter and that they, too, will respond in a proportional way.
Absolutely. We had movie theaters that said that they would not show this, and we certainly can't fault the movie theaters for taking these threats that may or may not have been credible, but they had to take them seriously. And Sony had to react in response. If no one was going to show their film, how do they release it? And this will cost Sony anywhere from $70 to $90 million just for not releasing, let alone the amount of money that they would have made off of the film and the reputational costs, of course, of this credibility. But you're right. It becomes a security issue, and we're talking about what might be classified as cybersecurity or cyber warfare. It was sponsored by North Korea, and the government has said as much. They seem to have the capabilities or the connections to do something that we perhaps didn't think they had the capabilities of doing 10 months ago, a year ago. They threatened this when they first heard about the film. And I think most people kind of, North Korea, how are they going to actually be able to do this? But it becomes very important because North Korea, who's sitting isolated in Asia, may not have the military capacity to get at a country like the United States, but they do apparently have the cyber capacity to wreak havoc and affect the entertainment industry and millions of people that would have viewed perhaps this film and the money that would have been made off of it.
Well, the implications for future attacks in that this was a successful cyber attack and focusing not only on government but and industry. And so the lessons that other potential cyber warriors might learn from this.
Well, it's certainly a scary situation because if they can do it, anyone can do it perhaps. If they can do it, anyone can do it. And we're probably looking at a new day of warfare. We've been hearing about cybersecurity, but no one has really been able to do all that much about it. We need to be paying a lot more attention to the possibilities that this could lead to chaos.
Very interesting, Rebecca. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions for Rebecca or me, let us know in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU and find us on Facebook by searching for KGOU. The two of us are on Twitter as well, at Suzette Guerlot and at Cruz226. Next, University of Oklahoma Director of Religious Studies Charles Kimball joins me in the studio for a conversation about his two most recent books and his four-decade career studying the intersection of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. I'm Suzette Guerlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlot. My guest, Charles Kimball, returned to his home state in 2008 to lead the religious studies program at the University of Oklahoma. The ordained Baptist minister earned his doctorate from Harvard in comparative religion in the late 1970s, where he specialized in Islamic studies. He's made more than 36 trips to the Middle East and often works closely with Congress, the White House, and the U.S. State Department as an analyst of Jewish-Christian-Muslim relations and the intersection of religion and politics in the United States. His most recent books, When Religion Becomes Evil, and its follow-up, When Religion Becomes Lethal, explore the turning point that makes faith violent and deadly. Charles Kimball, welcome to Worldviews.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Tell us how you were drawn, why you were drawn to this topic from the very beginning.
Good question. There are actually a couple of different things, but I'll zero in just on two that were very important. I would say I grew up in a fairly typical post-World War II baby boom family. My parents were, Presbyterian Methodist, but my grandfather on my father's side was Jewish. And his wife, my grandmother, was Presbyterian. My father and his brothers all became Christians, but had a very large extended family, mostly in the Boston area, that was Jewish. And I grew up being taught and experiencing that we're Christians, but it's also good to be Jewish. And when I hit a certain point in elementary school, when I began to realize not everybody else had such a positive view of Judaism, that raised questions because my grandfather was the most wonderful person I knew. And there was a part of me that knew, well, if I'd been born in another part of my own family, I'd be Jewish. So how do you make sense of all that? Alongside that, like a lot of other people probably who are listening, I was very involved with Young Life in high school and for 2 years dated seriously a Baptist minister's daughter. And so that drew me much more deeply into the dominant Protestant tradition in Oklahoma, the Baptist. And so I was very much sort of pursuing that in my own – just at a personal level, my own religiosity. But I still had these questions about sort of how religion works and how do you make sense of religious diversity. Was I just lucky to be born into the right religion or is there something else going on? And those factors ultimately kind of converged in a way that and I had some great mentors as well in college and beyond in seminary and then my doctoral program at Harvard to really help me learn how to think about and study about the various religious traditions of the world and sort of see where I fit in the Christian tradition, the largest religion, but how to negotiate that. And that's something I've been fascinated with my whole life. What we would call questions of particularity and pluralism. How do you see yourself in the midst of such diversity? And each of the religions have to wrestle with this, and some do it very explicitly, some a lot less so. But that was kind of what drew me both academically but also very much personally and experientially down this road.
Well, it's interesting that where you ended up was spending a lot of time in the Middle East
right.
and studying Islam. And, of course, we turn to you now as an expert on all religions, but certainly on Islam. Mm-hmm. So how did you move in that direction? What was it that prompted you to say it's time now to look at Islam as an important religion, as one of the three dominant religions around the world?
Well, I did a minor, effectively a double major. They just didn't offer a minor as an undergraduate. And so I had a lot of work in biblical studies and church history and so forth. Then I went to seminary for 3 years and did a great deal more with Judaism and Christianity and some of world religions. In the doctoral program at Harvard in comparative religion, we had what was called a two-tradition approach. You study all the major religious traditions and have to become proficient, but then you specialize in two. In my case, it's expected you bring one of them with you, in my case, Christianity. And then I zeroed in on another, and I was really fascinated by that point in my early 20s with this intersection of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, which are so organically linked together historically with sacred people, sacred places, sacred events that they share. I started my doctoral program in 1975. Well, you can think back very quickly. The 67 war, the 73 war, Lebanon was about to erupt in 76 with what turned out to be a multi-year civil war, multi-sided civil war. You had the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and then the Iranian Revolution in 79. So all those things were really happening. And in 77, 78, my wife and I lived in Cairo as a part of the doctoral program. And that really drew me in even more to contemporary Islam because I originally was studying more Quran and early Islamic history. But I got much more intrigued and drawn into the contemporary scene. And looking at ways, because I felt firmly and I believe very strongly now that at the heart of these three traditions, indeed all the major traditions that have stood the test of time, is a real strong push for peace and cooperation and justice and equity. People have not lived out those values terribly well in every instance, to be sure, as we see readily all around us today. But those are the principles. Those are the virtues. And so as someone who is not only interested intellectually, academically, but very much experientially, there's a part of me that was sort of torn between the ministerial track and an academic track, that there's very much a part of me that wants to be trying to be constructively involved, not just sort of solving intellectual problems, but really being engaged with people and hopefully making some positive contributions in a world where religion is often a source of conflict, not healing.
I'm talking with the University of Oklahoma's Director of Religious Studies, Charles Kemble. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzek Rorlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rorlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Today, I'm talking with Charles Kemble, who leads the Religious Studies program at OU. When we left off, he described what drew him to spending his career as a comparative religion scholar. He's also an ordained Baptist minister, and says his goal is to engage with people and positively contribute to a world where religion is sometimes a source of conflict rather than healing. Well, I think it's interesting that you talk about – you make a distinction there about what people believe and then how they behave. And I think one of the interesting things that has come out of your work as I read it is that you make this distinction about kind of religious belief and religious expression and kind of highlighting or making these distinctions between corrupt and authentic forms of religion. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? And I guess, is that ultimately what we're trying to understand here, is not just what people believe, but how they use those beliefs to then engage with one another? And how religion influences our relationships and our behavior in a social context.
Yeah, that's in the book, When Religion Becomes Evil, that's a primary focus. And the premise is really after 9/11, to take a step back and say, as I say in the book, you know, when you're standing on the edge of a cliff, progress is not defined as one step forward. So take a step back and say we're at a point in time when we can look across the centuries and across the religious traditions. Can we identify some of the warning signs of religion going awry when people who are deeply sincere and believe that they are living out what God wants them to do end up doing things that seem to be diametrically opposed to what they advocate? Ask most Christians, and they will readily tell you that Jesus taught a gospel of love. Ask many Jews about the history of Jewish-Christian relations, and they will tell you 2,000 years of Christian love is almost more than we Jews can bear. When you look at the history of anti-Semitism, it's horrific. Muslims readily say Islam means peace, and it does. That's literally what the term means. It means submission to God and peace. But to claim that and then see the kind of extremist behavior, albeit it's on the fringes of Islam, but still the numbers are significant and the behavior is horrific. It doesn't look like when you fly an airplane into a building or behead somebody that's peace at work. But somehow people rationalize, justify that. And that's what I really deal with in that book. What are the warning signs? It's the abuse of sacred texts. It's the danger of blind obedience to charismatic leaders, situations where we see in all traditions where somebody raises up a particular or they identify a particular end that becomes sacrosanct, and then anything is justified to reach that end. And we're seeing dynamics of that obviously today as well. And I talk also about the whole notion of holy war, that especially in Christianity and Islam, that is one of the traditions that runs through. In Christianity, you have pacifism, just war, and holy war, crusade. And certainly in Islam, the whole term holy war and the notion of jihad is understood in various ways, but it's primarily promoted, certainly via the media, as this a holy war, kill anybody who gets in your way. Many, many Muslims, a vast majority of Muslims would take exception to that, of course. But that's what gets a lot of media attention, and so I deal with that too. And part of what I plea for in that book, in that chapter, is that surely we've reached a point where we can see that everybody has always justified their wars by God wants us to do this. We have to stop laying our war at God's feet. If you can make the case for military action, make the case on its own merits, but don't say it's because God wants us to do it.
Well, this leads directly to your most recent book. You were referring to When Religion Becomes Evil, but your next book was When Religion Becomes Lethal. And, you know, so you're talking about war and violence and all of these uses and abuses, misuses of religion. But in this work, you talk about the explosive mix of religion and politics, and that the two of them, when those two come together, that's when these things happen. That it's not necessarily, as we were talking about, how religious beliefs go awry and causes certain behavior, but that it's when it becomes conflated with and connected to political processes that this is likely to happen. So why is that? Can you help us make sense of that?
Sure. And some of that is in When Religion Becomes Evil as well, because it does get connected to political movements and visions and so forth. But in When Religion Becomes Lethal, as you're noting, it's a very explicit effort to look at the question of the intersection of religion and politics historically, with contemporary examples, and with where do we go from here? What can we do? At one level, I think we have to say that religion and politics are always going to be linked somehow, partly because we're dealing with human beings who are, you know, the vast majority of whom perceive themselves to be religious. And so that's a part of the dynamic. But how that is structured, how that relates, I think one of the major discoveries in the book is that when you look at the history of these three traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, what we find is there is actually no template for how you do this. Even though you could turn on your TV and you'd hear plenty of people who have – they know exactly what God wants for Christian America, or they know exactly what God wants for an Islamic state, they say. Well, that's one version. That's an interpretation. But there is no template in Islam. There is no template in Christianity. There are hints and clues, and what we find historically are all kinds of experiments, and that's really what I trace out. What are the biblical bases for claiming a Christian state? Or what do the Quran and Hadith teach us, and how do Muslims actually apply that historically? And what we find is that they're all over the place in all these traditions. It's always a work in progress. It's always connected to contemporary circumstances. So part of what we're looking at today, and we're in the midst of a maelstrom, obviously, at the moment, with the horrific events and the upheavals in various places in the Middle East, especially in the Middle East. What we're looking at are changes that have political implications and efforts to structure in a world of nation states, which in and of itself is a new dynamic, fairly new in human history. How do we organize that? and you have many competing visions, some of which are violent and extreme. And, of course, those are the ones that tend to get the most attention. You're not hearing about the conferences where people are reflecting on how we can democratically organize a parliament and have elections and do this and that in the same sort of way as you get when you have explosive, you know, dynamics and people putting things up on social media and so forth. And so the question is, how do we move forward in a way? And here I argue at the end, in the end of the book, and I'm obviously cutting to the chase in a very quick way here, part of what I argue is that the United States, for all of our foibles and flaws and missteps and bad decisions under both Democratic and Republican leadership over the years, we've actually been engaged in an experiment in religious pluralism and diversity, where we have tried to fairly judiciously separate religion and politics and provide the opportunity for freedom of religion and freedom from religion for people. That is the First Amendment, America's first freedom. And we have really, I think, found a formula that's unique in human history but is desperately needed in the 21st century. So hopefully we can live out our own vision better and better and demonstrate to the world that there are ways to live together, maintain your religious identity, your deep commitments, but be respectful of diversity and respectful of people who say no to religion, that people have the freedom to do that and still have a voice in society. That, I think, is going to be more than anything else the challenge of the 21st century. And I would underscore this makes it all the more important for us in the United States, and particularly I'll speak as a member of the majority community of Christianity, that we be particularly vigilant at protecting the religious rights and freedoms of minority communities in our own country so that we are not only living up to our own ideals, but and we really are practicing freedom of religion, but we also model for the rest of the world that it is possible to do this. And indeed, this is vitally important in the 21st century. And so that to me is a place where we can be actually very constructively involved in a middle and long-term sort of way to live out our own values and be the light that the rest of the world desperately needs to see.
Well, Charles, thank you for being here today to enhance our understanding of this important role that religion plays in society. Thank you.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Charles Kimball, the Director of Religious Studies at the University of Oklahoma. There's more information and a link to his books, When Religion Becomes Evil and When Religion Becomes Lethal, on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and OU's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and Symphony Swift serves as our research fellow. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Perlott.